a labor advocate. Since some federal employees live paycheck to paycheck, he says ending the shutdown isn't automatically enough.
Even if funding were restored tomorrow, they would still need to wait the remainder of the pay period to be paid for the work they've done. Even after funding is restored, it will have continued effects on the officers.
As expected, the Federal Reserve cut interest rates by a quarter point. The stock market seemed disappointed, possibly seeking a bigger reduction, but economists say the Fed is balancing concerns about tariffs, sparking inflation with slowing employment and uncertainty from the government shutdown. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker is declaring an agricultural export crisis there due to Trump's tariffs. It comes as the president is proposing buying 80,000 metric tons of beef from Argentina as a short-term solution to bring down grocery store prices. Beef is an import commodity for Illinois, and Pritzker says the state will use every tool it can to support ranchers and farmers.
This order directs our state agencies to take immediate action, promoting domestic markets for agricultural commodities and expanding health resources for our rural communities.
I'm Edwin J. Vier.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 30th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Public News Service. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. Here are today's top stories. Trump breaks off trade talks with Canada. On the environmental front, children's health, Alaska drilling, and weather forecasting. And the latest on the rare earth controversy with China. Trump breaks off trade talks with Canada. President Trump abruptly canceled trade talks with Canada, and for the most absurd of reasons. He resented Ontario province's airing of a 1987 speech to the nation by President Reagan, in which the president warned against trade protectionism and weaponization of tariffs. The warning came at a time when the U.S. trade deficit with Japan had ballooned. "Remember, America's jobs and growth are at stake," Reagan said. Trump took that airing to be an interference in U.S. affairs. Imagine that. And an effort to persuade the Supreme Court to rule against his tariff policies. Since Trump didn't like the message, he made a typical response. "It's fake," which, of course, it isn't. Reagan's words are particularly salient at this moment when economists predict U.S. companies will begin passing on their tariff costs to consumers in a major way. Trump's threat worked for the most part. Ontario Premier Doug Ford said the ad campaign would be put on hold, quote, "so that trade talks can resume." He said he told his team to, quote, "keep putting out our message in front of Americans over the weekend so that we can air our commercial during the first two World Series games," which is what happened. Still, Trump wasn't satisfied. His vengeful side came out as he said he was imposing an additional 10% tariff on Canadian goods, those not covered by the U.S.-Canada-Mexico Pact, meaning steel, aluminum, and lumber. The legality of Trump's tariffs remains to be determined by the Supreme Court. Meantime, Democrats in the Senate, joined by five Republicans, are pushing for a vote on the tariff on Canada. They have already succeeded in gaining a bipartisan vote to end tariffs on Brazil. As Senators Tim Kaine and Rand Paul say in a Washington Post op-ed, the tariffs are reckless, unconstitutional actions that risk sending our country full steam ahead into economic chaos. Next, three pieces of environmental news concerning children's health, Alaska drilling, and weather forecasting. A legal case in Montana on climate change and children's health rights was decided last month. 22 young people filed the lawsuit to counter three of the Trump administration's executive orders promoting reliance on fossil fuels. A federal judge ruled against the plaintiffs, despite largely agreeing with their argument about the detrimental effects of Trump's environmental policies on children's health. The basis for the judge's ruling was that the court did not have the power to monitor and determine which federal agency would need to change its policies to bring climate change under control. The lawsuit was filed in May by Our Children's Trust and Public Justice, two public interest law firms. They said they would appeal the decision. In Alaska, Trump has cleared the way for oil and gas companies to bid on leases in the National Wildlife Refuge, a pristine wilderness of about 1.5 million acres that is critical home to many wildlife. The sale of leases will start in winter. In addition, Trump's Interior Department will allow roads to be built through the Izembek National Wildlife Refuge in southwest Alaska and in another wilderness area that reaches a copper and zinc mine in northern Alaska. Whether and to what extent the oil and gas companies bid remains to be seen, since some, along with some banks, have worried in the past about the cost, the impending lawsuits, and the bad publicity. On a more positive note, U.S. weather catastrophes are again being traced. Despite the Trump administration's best efforts to hide the effects of climate change, a new nonprofit group called Climate Central has revived a database on major weather disasters. Through the first 6 months of this year, disasters across the U.S. caused more than $100 billion in damage, the most expensive start to any year on record. 14 disasters each caused at least $1 billion in damage through the first half of the year, the researchers found. The average number of billion-dollar disasters has surged from 3 per year during the 1980s to 19 annually during the last 10 years, the data show. This kind of information butts up against the administration's plan to shift FEMA's mission so that the states are mainly responsible for the costs of disasters. The latest on the rare earth controversy with China. Another momentary standoff has been reached in the U.S.-China tariff war as reciprocal high tariffs have been suspended while President Trump and President Xi meet in South Korea to try to work out differences over Chinese rare earth exports and U.S. export controls on advanced technology. The Chinese Ministry of Commerce has defended its controls on rare earth exports by noting that only rare earths used for military purposes will be barred. Its statement says that, quote, China's export control is not a ban on exports. As long as export applications are for civilian use and are compliant, they can all be approved and relevant enterprises need not worry, unquote. In response to the 100% tariff rate threatened by Trump, the ministry accused the U.S. of double standards, saying, quote, for a long time, the U.S. side has generalized the concept of national security, abused export control, adopted discriminatory practices against China, and imposed unilateral long-arm jurisdiction measures on numerous products, such as semiconductor equipment and chips. The U.S. export control list contains more than 3,000 items, whereas the Chinese export control list contains just over 900 items, unquote. Reportedly, China will relax but not end its rules governing rare earth exports in return for a similar relaxation of U.S. rules on high-tech exports. Australia may give the U.S. one alternative source of rare earths. Its Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, and Trump have worked out a deal that will probably require huge investments by the U.S. No other details have been released. The administration is pursuing other avenues to obtain rare earth minerals. It is buying stakes in U.S. companies that will mine and refine them. But there are hazards to that strategy, as the New York Times points out, quote, Constructing the mines, refineries, and factories needed to provide a real alternative to Chinese supplies will take years, even if foreign producers can obtain the machinery and technology they need, which the Chinese government has also proposed controlling. These investments will also require substantial capital, creating the risk that some taxpayer funds will go to unproven companies that could fail. Unmentioned here are the environmental risks of mining, a problem seen in China where rare earth mining is a major environmental hazard. In other news, the U.S. lead over China in scientific research has evaporated. Professor Carolyn Wagner at The Ohio State University tracks trends in China's educational system. Her latest work finds that China has overtaken the U.S. in scientific research, specifically by 17% in the number of publications in the world's leading scientific journals. As recently as 2020, the U.S. had led China by 53% in published research. In specific fields, quote, China is leading the U.S. in outputs in chemistry, physical sciences, and earth and environmental sciences. The U.S. leads China in biological and health sciences. At the same time, Chinese collaborations with U.S. and other scientists in publishing scientific papers have declined. Not long ago, U.S.-China collaborative research led the world. Perhaps most remarkable about China's surge is that quality of research is in step with quantity. Wagner finds that an examination of, quote, the world's top 1% of most highly cited papers showed that China had already achieved rough parity with the U.S. in this crucial quality metric. Papers cited frequently enough to rank in the top 1% globally, indicating the frontiers of research, unquote. Her conclusion reflects not just China's achievements, but Trumpian America's hostility to science. Here's the quote. The uncomfortable truth is that China's research rise reflects genuine scientific achievement. Chinese universities have hired aggressively, built world-class facilities, and created competitive funding systems. Chinese researchers are publishing breakthrough work in quantum computing and renewable energy that merit publication in the journals Nature and Science, regardless of the author's nationality, unquote. Trump sanctions Russia, but how meaningful is it? Trump's summit proposal has been rejected by Russia, and in turn, Trump has imposed the first sanctions on Russia. They aim at Russia's two largest oil companies, Rosneft and Lukoil, and anyone doing business with them around the world. Those companies will not be able to use American banking facilities for their transactions, which could deal a heavy blow to Russia's chief source of revenue, particularly at a time when its economy is growing at a mere 1% annually. The European Union also imposed sanctions, banning imports of Russian liquefied natural gas. Russia's foreign ministry issued a response saying, quote, if the current U.S. administration starts following the example of its predecessors, the result will be exactly the same, disastrous from a domestic political perspective and detrimental to global economic stability, unquote. Most observers seem to agree that the sanctions will not change Putin's course, partly because his rule depends on victory over Ukraine, and partly because he expects that Trump will change his mind in a few months. As for the Ukrainians, they're elated about the sanctions, but also believe providing them with Tomahawk missiles would have had far greater impact on Putin's thinking. Trump's Asia trip nets another Nobel supporter. During a stopover in Tokyo, President Trump and the new Japanese Prime Minister, Takeuchi Sanai, pronounced the start of a new golden age in U.S.-Japan relations. What could be more golden for Trump than Takeuchi's pledge to nominate Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize? That's just as valuable to him as a trade deal, which, however, remains to be concluded. One thing Trump is sure to gain with Takeuchi in charge is this, an increase in Japan's military spending and closer ties with the U.S. in containing China. Next, inconvenient threats. In much the same way that data on threats to the environment have been buried by the Trump administration, Tulsi Gabbard, Director of National Intelligence, has buried the intelligence community's data gathering on certain external security threats, including climate change. Intelligence analysts are being accused of violating, quote, professional analytic tradecraft standards in an effort to propagate a political agenda contrary to Trump's. They have been dismissed. This news belongs in a package of Trump administrative actions that reduce the role of intelligence gathering altogether. Gabbard's office has closed the National Intelligence University and sharply reduced the number of officers working on foreign malign influence and election threats. Just last week, it was reported that data gathering on cyber hacking had also been greatly reduced, precisely at the moment Chinese hacking has increased. Once upon a time, all these intelligence activities had bipartisan support. U.S. diplomats will be involved in a Gaza monitoring center. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said that a growing number of diplomats would work with American military officers at a new civil-military coordination center in southern Israel, aimed at monitoring the ceasefire in Gaza. Trouble is, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is renewing attacks on Gaza, just the other day killing 100 people, arguing that Hamas has violated the ceasefire. Rubio also reiterated that the Trump administration might seek a mandate from the United Nations for an international peacekeeping force in at least part of Gaza. He also repeated Trump's promise that Israel will not be allowed to annex the West Bank. Yet, a right-wing resolution to annex has passed in the Israeli parliament. Finally, two news updates. North Korean troops are now operating inside Ukraine, according to the British Defense Ministry. The ministry says, quote, "This is the first time North Korean troops have been reported as directly supporting or facilitating Russian offensive operations into sovereign Ukrainian territory," unquote. The North Koreans are acting as spotters for Russian artillery, a significant addition to their combat role, in which as many as 15,000 North Korean soldiers have been sent to the front lines. And from Argentina, President Javier Milei's government will get to keep the $40 billion in U.S. loans and private investment that Donald Trump promised if Milei's party came out on top in midterm elections. It did, winning around 40% of the vote, despite Milei's austerity policies that have hit many Argentinians hard. His win is also a victory for Argentina's soybean farmers, who are displacing American farmers' soybean exports to China, and for Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent's buddies, who have major stakes in Argentina's financial market. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
Cable News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KABU News in Depth. I'm Josh Salem. 1 in 6 Oregonians receive support from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also called SNAP. SNAP provides monthly food monies to those in need. But recipients won't receive their benefits next month due to the federal shutdown. The program is federally funded, and Congress hasn't passed a short-term spending package. KABU's Anna Wilcox spoke with David Wieland from Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon about what's happening with SNAP and where people can find support.
How much of an issue is hunger in Oregon?
We know that the root cause of hunger is wealth inequality, and that falls along lines of race and class and gender across our state, and disproportionately affects some folks. On a whole, we see about 1 in 8 people experiencing food insecurity, which is sort of like not knowing where your food will come from that week. And that rate is 2 to 3 times higher for Black Oregonians, for Indigenous Oregonians, or single parents. So depending on where you live and who you are, this can be really present in your life, but also hunger and food insecurity can be really invisible to folks around us. So a lot of folks are often sort of working in silence or in private to try and get their needs met. And SNAP is one of those things that, like we said, 1 in 6 Oregonians can rely on month to month to provide some amount of security, and the dignity to choose food that meets their needs that month.
Really, so many people that are going to be affected by these cuts. What is food insecurity?
Well, I think when people hear hunger, they think of the experience in your body where you're like, you need food now. Too many Oregonians experience that on a daily basis, but even more folks have the experience of not knowing what whether they'll have enough to eat the next day or later in the week, or they have to make really difficult choices about maybe eating less than they know they should, or eating, making choices about their food to prioritize calories instead of things that they know are healthy for them. And that's what food insecurity looks like. It's that whole realm of experiences where Oregonians are not able to meet the needs that they know that they have, or have to spend their time worrying about or anxious about what comes next for them.
I think that what you just said really gives some context into why this is so important and why we really need to be paying attention to the current cuts in these benefits, which are going to affect just so many people and so many people's access to a basic need. So what's happening with SNAP? Can you give an overview from your professional perspective?
Yeah. I mean, SNAP has existed as a federally funded program for more than 60 years. About 42 million Americans each month get grocery benefits that average about $6 a day per person. Again, to be able to make choices about their groceries and get the food that they know will meet their needs, or at least help to get to that. Right now, the federal government has been shut down for about the last month, and we're in the next federal fiscal year, and there is not allocated money. There's not money allocated for SNAP. The point of contention that we're really faced at right now is that advocates and folks like us know that the federal government has a contingency fund to pay for SNAP in situations like this. But the Trump administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture are refusing to use that money to pay for November benefits. We think that's illegal, immoral, but we're getting down to the wire where if action isn't taken, you know, today or yesterday, folks will see delays in benefits issued in November. We absolutely believe that once there is a resolution, folks will get paid their full November benefits. But, you know, so many people in Oregon can't wait. Most folks I know that use SNAP have used up those benefits by week two or three. So every day we delay is a really difficult reality for, like we said, one in six Oregonians who are counting on this program to meet their basic needs.
So what is being done in Oregon right now to buffer or counteract the shortfall? Are you able to speak about?
Well, what's on the line in Oregon is about each month about $140 million comes from a federal account and is loaded onto SNAP cards across the state. That's the big question we're facing. When will that money come? What can happen in the meantime? Our state leaders, our congressional offices, hundreds of organizations across the state have been united in the last week in demanding that USDA release its contingency funding and ensure at least partial benefits go out to SNAP participants on time. The state doesn't have a whole lot of options to fill that gap. The federal government has made it clear that they won't reimburse states if they were to, say, load their own dollars onto SNAP cards. What we're really seeing is this is Oregonians' hunger being used as a political weapon in this moment. And it's horrifying.
Thank you so much for sharing. So For people who are losing benefits as of November 1st, what do they need to know now? Where can they go and find support?
I mean, first, I just want to clarify that we have a lot of confidence that when this situation is resolved, folks will receive the benefits that they're due in November. We just don't know when that will be. We also know that if you continue to apply for SNAP now, you'll get benefits dated back to when you apply. So don't wait to apply if you are hearing news about SNAP right now. Every day matters. For folks who are facing down this really impossible future of not seeing their SNAP benefits, we are really relying on the resilience of our communities to fill that gap. And it's a huge gap, but we know that food banks and mutual aid projects and even restaurants across the state, we've been seeing step up and get as many resources as they can to folks, their neighbors who are going to be in need soon and may already be in need. So there's a couple of places you can go. One is to call or text or visit 211, the hotline that can help direct folks to food resources. The Oregon Department of Human Services is standing up extra free food markets across the state. And many folks, including Partners for Hunger Free Oregon, are compiling sort of statewide, community-specific lists of places you can go, not only to get food assistance, but things like rental assistance or utilities or anything that can help soften the blow in this moment.
What personally drives you to do this work? How did you get involved?
I've been on SNAP. I've received free school meals. I've relied on unemployment, used free grocery projects and pantries. These things kept me alive. And for too many people, that's been our experience. I think everyone in Oregon deserves the dignity to eat what nourishes them and reflects their cultural values. And this is just a right that we should have in Oregon. And we're building towards that in small ways, even in these dark times. This year, nearly every public school in Oregon provides free breakfast and lunch. We're going to work in and ensure that's every public school. But I think it's a really small but important way out of this. We now live in a state where children have a right to food when they show up to school. They cannot be denied breakfast or lunch. And we're working towards a world where that right extends to everyone, even if it hits setbacks and is difficult and our opposition is making it more difficult. We're actually moving forward in some other ways, and we're going to keep building the power to get there.
That's beautiful. You know, in Oregon, like 1 in 6 people receive SNAP benefits, so they need that food assistance and support to just access their basic right to food. SNAP on a good day isn't necessarily a perfect system to begin with. How are the changes that are happening now, will they impact how we approach hunger in the U.S. in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you've probably covered or heard the changes to federal laws that will impact SNAP eligibility in the future. And those things include further limiting which lawfully present immigrants in Oregon can receive SNAP in the first place, restricting refugees, asylees from using the program. Those include reinstating work requirements across adults without dependents, in a program where nearly every SNAP participant is already working. We know the impact of that is that folks are caught in paperwork traps and largely lose the benefits that they should be eligible for, even under these harsh new rules. And we also know that benefits will either be reduced or frozen moving forward for a system that already can't meet the rising cost of groceries. So the question is a really important one. SNAP is hugely important in Oregon, and it's increasingly being designed to not meet the needs of most people. We believe and will continue to push for programs that increasingly seek to address the root causes of hunger, and we know that to be the historic wealth inequality that exists in Oregon right now. Things like the child tax credit that reduces taxes for folks, for children, and ensures that that money is not just grocery money, but is money that families can use to meet whatever their needs are. And continuing to address the wealth inequality that is driving hunger is going to have to be our future approach. As Oregon designs solutions to hunger, and the federal government steps back from that responsibility that they have, we get to apply our own values, and we get to say we won't exclude anyone for any reason. We won't exclude refugees and asylees from our state benefits. And it's going to be a fight to do that, but that's possible here in Oregon, and we believe it, and we've seen it. It's going to be difficult, but I think in every crisis like this, we are forced to take the opportunity to look back at our values and say,